Savvy Business Radio, home to over 500,000 listeners per month, and runs in syndication on 8 AM/FM stations nationwide, including iHeartRadio and 6 podcasting platforms. To find out about our paid sponsorship opportunities or to become a guest and find out how we can help you get your message out in a bigger way, call 732-474-7375 or email Christina at savvybusinessradio.com.
Our first guest today is Dr. Kevin Ryan, MD, sharing his book, When Tumor is the Rumor and Cancer is the Answer, a comprehensive text for newly diagnosed patients and their families. His book and website are a therapeutic labor of love and gratitude for his patients and families who have entrusted their lives to his care for over 30 years. Visit today and get your book at whentumoristhe rumorandcanceristhe answer.com. Hello, Dr. Kevin P. Ryan. Welcome to Savvy Business Radio. How are you today?
I'm well. I'm happy to talk to you. This is a very important topic for the 88% of us out there who know, knew, or will know someone with cancer. And when you consider there's 2.2 million cases of cancer, you're looking at 40 to 50 million people every year who are affected because there's a mom, a dad, a sister, a brother, a child. You get the point.
Oh, yeah.
So it has a profound impact, and a large number, 600,000, will die within the first year of being diagnosed, even as we are making clear progress. So this is the number one fear of all people when asked. Heart attacks, strokes, HIV, name whatever you wish, cancer is number one.
Yeah, and you yourself, now this is very unique because you are an MD doctor, but you have yourself written a book, When Tumor is the Rumor and Cancer is the Answer. What's so important about this is that you've gone through having to be dealing with a diagnosis yourself, and you've come out the other end and you realize what some of the things are that stop us from healing ourselves. One being the thought immediately that this is a death sentence. The minute you get some sort of diagnosis that you even contemplate the fact that it could be cancer.
You know, I like to explain that there are words that we confuse as being synonymous and are not. Mm-hmm. And one example that's germane to our discussion is anxiety and fear.
Yeah.
Fear is when you know what you are afraid of and you marshal your resources appropriate to the offense that you sense. Mm-hmm. Anxiety is fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. And in cancer, fear of the unknown will kill you. I've often used the analogy, which is, of course, archaeologically impossible, but imagine two caves filled with clans of our primordial ancestors, and one is fretting away that they just know that there's carnivores that will kill them if they step outside the cave. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, they will starve, and they will die. Mm-hmm. And another over the other side of the mountain says they're out there, but we can make spears, we can make sticks, we can make sharp objects, we can fight, we can find a way, but we can't stay in this cave. They're both fear of the unknown. They don't know when they're going to be attacked, from where and by what. Mm. But they make action. They go forward. They get knowledge. And that is the antidote to anxiety. Getting knowledge. Appropriate, accurate, comprehensive, compassionate, and most of all, comprehensible knowledge about that which you are facing.
This leads me to a very interesting question. I remember many years ago, I had 8 people in my family die of cancer in 1 year. And it kind of scared the little daylights out of me. And I started looking for alternatives. Even though I didn't have anything in my system yet considered cancer in any shape or form, I did not ever want to go there. So I started looking into alternative therapies, lifestyles, all that sort of thing. And I talked to a lot of people who had tried alternative therapies, some of them really far out there. And they had positive results. And I bring it to doctors and they say, well, that's hogwash. They just believe it and that's why it worked. And then I said, well, what's the difference? If it's a belief that makes things work, then maybe we should study that puppy. What's your take on that, on the whole alternative?
Well, let's deconstruct, as I used to do on a debating team of my Ivy League school, the conclusion first.
Okay.
That it worked.
All right.
You're assuming that it worked. We don't know that. What we know is that allegedly, the malignancy, which I know nothing about and have no data which in front of me, remitted. And we have no idea whether that was going to be the natural course of event. Number two, the placebo effect is 10 to 12%. Those who believe that they are going to have a positive outcome truly more often have a positive outcome than those who do not, who receive identical therapy. Third, the internet has brought us one of the most famous physicians, eclipsing Louis Pasteur, Sigmund Freud, Salk, Sabin, all physicians of all time, and it's Dr. Google. And it's the worst physician we could possibly go to. He has a child known as WebMD. Now, if I were to tell you I owned a Ford and we were at the embarkation port of where all the Fords come into Northern California and it was a Ford Focus, you couldn't find mine. And if I were to tell you it was white, you still couldn't find mine. And if I were to tell you it was white and it had air conditioning and windows that went up and down and a thing in the back that, you know, was special in some manner, you still couldn't know which one was mine unless you had the vehicle identification number. So specificity is absolutely critical. The devil is in the details. Now, this is not to say that complementary and alternative medicine has no role. 40% of our cancer patients are going to be looking into it, and doctors would be fools to not know that patients will be doing this. Rather, they should embrace this in the first visit straight on. And not as a till of the Hun, but embrace it straight on as you're going to be doing this, or if you don't, your Uncle Tallulah is going to do this, or your aunt whatever is going to be doing this, or your daughter, or someone who immediately gets an MD, PhD from the school of nothingness in oncology is going to be doing this. But you're going to be fishing for this because you are scared spitless. That is understandable. Bring in what you find, and let's talk about what a controlled clinical trial is. That being said, the majority of these substances, nearly 99%, have never been submitted to the rigors of a controlled clinical trial where, for example, if you want to know the best way to get to a certain destination on average from your home, you would do it multiple times, controlling every variable, the air in your tires, the timing of the lights, the time of the day, the type of temperature outside, the weather, multiple variables that could affect the outcome before you ever made a conclusion. If you flipped a coin and you got six heads in a row, you would say, well, the odds of the next time flipping it, I get a head are, wow, they're 600%. No, they're not. They were 50-50 in the beginning and they're 50-50 now. You just didn't flip it enough times. With that being said, a number of our drugs have come from the plant and animal kingdom. And we need to remember that. Some, rather directly, we have podophyllotoxins from toads. We have aspirin, the American Indians, from the willow tree. We have, from other trees, from their bark, the taxanes, which is a category of chemotherapeutic agents, which are very powerful. We have antibiotics, which produce various substances to protect themselves and to kill things trying to kill them. So there are many sources which are organic, and there are many lessons we learn from the plant and animal kingdom that are algorithms of behavior or manners in which they handle the business of trying to stay alive, divide, and have children. So there is a lot to that world. But translating all of those caveats into saying, take complementary and alternative medicine, let's get practical. You're then saying, you're putting something in your body you don't know the purity of. Because there is no agency that makes you know the purity of it. The FDA has no control over them.
And
they're dietary supplements. That's right. You don't know who made it. You don't know how it was made. There are no trials that tell you its interaction with other drugs until there are so many bad outcomes. We learn that, for example, laetril can be fatal. Mm-hmm. Remember that with peach pits? Mm-hmm. Cyanide.
Yeah, yeah.
We learn such things as vitamin C taken to too high a toxicity from a Nobel laureate mm-hmm. caused kidney crystals. Well, of course it could. Mm-hmm. And we learn many things that are bad. But we should pay attention to when we see two words that are very similar in sound, one of which can lead to the other. And the first is anecdote can possibly lead us to antidote, but it needs to be done in a systemic, scientific manner. A perfect example being marijuana versus tetrahydrocannabinol, one of the 60 or some odd cannabinoids inside of marijuana. Mm-hmm. Marijuana should be studied vastly more than it is now, which is zero.
Yeah.
It's illegal.
Now, can I?
Marijuana is illegal.
Mm-hmm. Now, this leads me to something very interesting because I didn't have Google growing up. This is 20 odd years ago. So I didn't have the internet and the web, so I think it was a blessing in disguise because with the 8 people in my family dying, it led me not only to reach out to folks who had been dealing with cancer and such and even doctors, but to actually go to medical journals, which I taxed over, and people actually thought I wanted to get a medical degree. And I was like, no, I don't really want to be a doctor. I just don't want to get this thing called cancer. But what I found very interesting, there were a lot of test studies done on medications and therapies and such that often when they started to have great results, the funding was cut. And that just left me like wondering, like, what's going on here? Does the medical establishment really want to cure cancer? Or is it too much money in the industry to actually ever go in that direction? What are your thoughts?
And this is a very common dialogue that occurs. So feel well that it's crossing your mind.
Okay.
Rest assured that yes, there has been a diminution of funds in the past for various promising clinical trials, and there can be a ponderous process, especially in the past and not now, for discovering. But keep in mind, it takes 5 to 7 years to take a possible substance or observation and bring it to the marketplace. Secondly, it's usually 1 out of 5,000 observations that ever make it to the marketplace. Thirdly, it's $600 to $800 million to develop that drug. That's a lot of steps. Thirdly, and fourthly, you have clinical trials that are absolutely essential to tell you, is it toxic? Mm-hmm. Will it kill people? Then how does it compare when there are people who have no other hope? Then how does it compare to the best available therapy at the time? And of all the time, you're collecting information on interactions and toxicity. And then does it have other uses than the one in which you intended? There is no grand conspiracy. If one had an MBA, and I do, and you were to look at the balance sheet of many of your pharmaceutical companies, especially the large ones, especially the ones that have patents that run out. They do run out, you know, giving others the opportunity to drive the price down, but protecting those who develop the drug to recoup their investment, because without which doing it, they would never try to develop the drug in the first place. So keep that in mind. So if you look at these balance sheets, you will see profits of 5%, 8%, on a good year, maybe 11 or 12%. That's all. They're not making a fortune. Initial public offerings of some drugs that come out that are blockbuster absolutely occur. And of course, they make the news. Of course, they'll make the news. But again, they will have a patent that immediately begins the life cycle of that drug, while others are already trying to imitate it and to make a better mousetrap. It cost them a fortune and years to develop it.
Now, why does it cost so much? Why is it so costly and so long for it to go through trials and stuff?
The science involved, just let's just think of some simple pedantic reasons. You have literally hundreds, perhaps thousands, internationally, of scientists who have to eat. Then you have all their equipment, which is enormous, because you have to know what it is that you are biochemically or chemically or both dealing with. So the logistics of the physical equipment and infrastructure, including people necessary, is enormous. Then you have the funding of the trials. Why would any university embark on a trial of a drug if there were no remuneration for per capita for enrollment of patients onto that drug? There'd be no point in doing it because they have an enormous amount of work to do to protect you, the patient. That drug has to be put through the institutional review board, where physicians of all walks of the institution, surgeons, radiologists, not just medical oncologists, examine and scrutinize the grammar, the linguistics, not just the concepts, not just the science, of the proposed treatment protocol, then the informed consent that the patient really knows what in the hell they are getting themselves into. Then and only then can it be approved to go forward into a trial. And in this nation, sadly, the bad news is we only have 7 to 9% of our eligible patients for clinical trials participate in them. Can you imagine the difference?
Why?
If we had more.
Why don't we have more?
People are afraid of the image and the specter that they are a guinea pig, and they are not. When a patient is terminal and has no other alternative, this is an ideal patient for one type of a series of drugs, phase one trials. When a patient has failed conventional therapy, and there's a series of possible second lines, but a very promising phase two drug, which has passed the phase one hurdle, again, they think that they may be a guinea pig. Third, the individual physician doesn't have the time or hasn't gone through the work to enroll the trial at their institution where it's not supported. You simply can't give the drug to the patient. You have to collect a huge amount of information regarding the logistics of the patient as well as medically. Who are they biochemically, physiologically? This costs money and time. Yeah. And then you have to do that in a serial, iterative manner so that you know what it is you think you know. Otherwise, you're shooting in the dark.
That's a lot. Yeah. And as my doctor was telling me, he said, you know what? I love serving my patients first, but I'm spending more and more time filling out insurance forms and such than I'm seeing patients. So for I think that might be another block in the system, in that I would love to help patients move towards a trial, but if I'm spending most of 90% of my time filling out paperwork, I can't even move in that direction.
It is. Now, the truth of the matter is that if you spend the time with the patient in the appropriate manner, and we go through this in the book very carefully, I don't know if you've had a chance to review or to look at it. If you do spend the time, you will get it back a millionfold, one in an existential manner. Because you have reached out to a frightened, suffering human soul that has come to you to lay their life in your hands. And that is a sacred thing since the days of the shaman and the medicine man to the subspecialist that we have now. It is a sacred thing. When patients would come to see me, I would marshal most of the people in the clinic, as many as were free, and I would usually schedule to make sure that they were free when a new patient came, and they would be greeted by them all and have it explained to them what their roles were, and that they would be told many, many times, and that we wanted them to be part of our family. We wanted to be part of their family. We wanted to do this so they were co-captain of the ship. And then we would assure them that they have the courage and are already sufficiently heroic to do what they absolutely are convinced they can never do and never have the heroism to do. And then I would shake their hand with both of my hands and square off and look at them in the eyes and say, thank you. And this would be rather disarming because I'm thanking them. And they would wonder why. And the reason is because you could choose many oncologists, but you choose us. Then we bring them into the room and I ask them about physical space. Do you want me standing across the room like Taras Bulba? As if I were Genghis Khan issuing edicts of we're going to do this and that, and this is what you'll be told, and that's all there is to it. Or do you want me sitting next to you? May I touch you? What is appropriate physical touch at appropriate times? Patients love that. It's disarming. Then I look at the person whom they asked to come in, and if they didn't, I ask them to ask someone who they think is responsible, not someone in the family who has issues, and everyone has issues, to be the scribe. If they don't have an MP3 recorder, we let them borrow one for the first visit, because I have no fear of what it is I'm about to tell them. And at every visit, I tell them, spend the $39.95 or even less to go get a simple recorder and record every visit so that you have questions. Why? Not only will you then know what you were told, not only will you then have better information to research it, but your questions will be improved. Your involvement in your care will be greater. Your quality of life will soar in comparison. Your sense of integrity and control will be incomparable. Your survival will be positively impacted. And you will then be, as I told you, co-captain of your ship. You will be autonomous, as the Supreme Court in 1896 indicated you are to be. Physicians are no longer to be magnificent demagogues, MD. They are, in fact. Yes, ma'am.
I would say, where were you when I was 20 years ago? I could have totally used you in my family. This is such a blessing that you operate this way. I really wish I'd had more experiences with MDs that operated in such, because my experiences were always like, we are the supreme beings. You do what we tell you, and we really don't want your questions. And I really like this approach.
I began teaching a long time ago, and this is the teaching that I have done until this very day. And it is the importance that the science really isn't that hard. If you didn't have the intellect to conquer at least the modicum of science that you needed to do what you do as a physician, you wouldn't be here. It's the humanity that counts. The average time that physicians spend, according to a recent study, in a patient's room before they interrupt the patient speaking, and of course, this becomes a training ritual. Eventually, the patient stops asking and stops talking, is 27 seconds.
Wow.
That's an obscenity. It is an obscenity. But if you spend the time where you square off and look into their eyes and tell them, whether it's verbally or non-verbally, that you're not just sympathetic, but that you're empathetic, which is a burden for yourself on one hand and a gift on the other, that you feel their fear and you feel how desperately they want to fight, but they don't know how. This is so uplifting to the patient. And you let them know the patient is the one with the cancer, but the family may have a disease, depression, anxiety. Histrionics. So pick the person who isn't telling you about Uncle Joe's Kickapoo Joy Juice that cured this, that, and the other thing. Pick a scribe, and then you get them into a support group, which is not depressing. In the beginning, they're freshmen. They're anxious. It's the first day of class. But those around them have been there in various stages and will lift them up and carry them in their arms and their hearts and their minds. And in time, they will be doing the teaching to others. I have seen never anything but heroism. and never anything but an increase in wisdom in my patients. I've had some that I didn't like who were real SOBs, but they brought that personality to the dance.
Yeah.
And I had no problem telling them. Frankly, only two come to mind, and they were both retired full colonels, which I am a retired full colonel.
Wow.
And they thought they were in control of everything. And, you know, I would just smile and sigh and say, and how are we going to be pissy today? You know, eventually one would laugh, you know, but they still would have that gruff attitude because that was their defensive mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me, do you not want to feel loved? Do you not want to feel cared for?
Mm-hmm.
Do you not want to feel understood? Do you not want to feel a trust that's in your soul, not just your mind? That's the easy part.
Mm-hmm.
But in your heart and in your gut, that this person is living part of their life for the sake of you dying to live rather than living to die.
That's amazing. And how was the journey for you when you had to go look for a doctor for yourself? Was it hard on you knowing what you know? I've often heard it said that ignorance is bliss, and you understanding full well what cancer is all about and the, working through it. Was it harder for you or easier for you? How did it work out for you?
It was harder. It was one of the most horrendous experiences in my life.
Wow.
I was a first-year fellow, and this sentiment, which we are now finally starting to get into the fellowship training of oncology fellows, of feel, let your heart be involved and engaged in what it is that you were doing. At the time, I looked at my arm and said, number one, you weren't there 2 weeks ago. Number two, that's a malignant melanoma. I had the training to know that right off the bat. I did my own biopsy. And I sat there at a microscope, which I can still smell the eyepieces and still feel the sitting there, something you never forget. It's like losing the lottery and your draft number is one back in 1971 during Vietnam. That kind of a feeling, you know what I mean? And seeing from my own eyes, you have stage two intermediate malignant melanoma, and there is no therapy, and you'll either recur and progress, or already have, or you won't. And that's that. And then I later learned that I had a syndrome that put me at even greater risk.
Whoa.
No one talked to me, not one mentor, not one teacher, not one colleague, not one student, except one patient who was a chief master petty officer, God is another way to say that, who was the last patient I would see on rounds who had multiple myeloma, which was going to kill him, and he knew that. But he knew that I had love, and I wanted to teach, and I wanted to change things if I could. And I would always bring in the medical students, and then they would leave, and like the little grasshopper conjuring up the days of old David Carradine's kung fu movies or television series, I'd sit at the end of his bed, and he would talk to the little grasshopper, and he would tell me great things. And he said to me, when you are done, you will collect stories, probably a dozen, and you will tell them in the book that you will write. And the book will be the book that tells people how to go through the process of where we started this interview, changing anxiety into action through knowledge. And that's how we started, and that's how we've come full circle. And he told me, you will write that. And in all of my lectures, I would occasionally put in a story. I would ask patients to edit sections that I had written. I didn't ask faculty to edit it. I knew how to write. I had been writing and publishing things long before, since high school. I wanted to know if I was reaching hearts, if I was touching the heart of the matter. And I would ask patients to edit it or to talk about them or to tell me things. Or I'd ask these vulnerable, scared medical students. Or I'd watch the look in the eyes and hopefully the tears in the eyes of some of the residents when I would tell them these stories. Mm-hmm. And then I grew and developed the table of contents, and it flows logically where it starts with autonomy. It's about you. You own you. Mm-hmm. No one else owns your body. You are in charge. Then anxiety. Then what? When you suspect, and we covered this in the interview, mm-hmm. we suspect the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. I didn't say we've made the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Then what happens when you're making the diagnosis, and what doesn't happen? Mm-hmm. And then what happens from there on? And everything is in there. Clinical trials, ethics, all types of medical law issues, everything, chemotherapy, side effects, mm-hmm. so that they can have this vast compendium of comprehensible mm-hmm. and compassionate knowledge, wherein they would become empowered to, once again, returning to the beginning of the interview, transmute that anxiety into action because of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. This is wonderful for anyone who's ever listening in, who's ever dealt with cancer or feels they will, has a family member who's dealt with cancer. Instead of going to WebMD or Google to get the answers, go check out this book today, When Tumor is the Rumor and Cancer is the Answer, to get the comprehensive answers and comprehensible answers you need to fight this with your doctor as a team. And please let them know where they can find out more about you also, Dr. Ryan.
Well, it's the bio is in there. My mother, of course, wrote it.
Aw, God bless her.
She's well, not really, but she would have killed me if I didn't put it. You know, the first dedication is her. I call her the 97-year-old Sicilian tsunami mommy. She's got zero diseases and manages a 60-year-old house in New England completely on her own.
Wow.
And she had a big influence in terms of scholarship. She was very much so an alpha female, quite an exception many, many years ago. And she had a lot to do with thinking and love of knowledge and learning. And the rest of my bio then follows, culminating in the foreword from the head of Cancer Treatment Centers of America, who essentially concludes in the foreword, if you're looking for one book mm-hmm. because you've been told you have cancer, you're holding it in your hand. That's how I ended it. Mm. And we had the rest of the book endorsed by a former Surgeon General who talks a little bit about me. So through that and the cover and the introduction and some of the bio, and on the website, it's a therapeutic website. It's very easy to negotiate. The best way to get to the website is identical to the book's title, When Tumor's the Rumor and Cancer is the Answer, .com/. That'll take them directly to the website and more than a couple of videos, but they'll be able to pull down anything they want and read anything they want. I give away all kinds of information because I don't care about selling books. All of this money goes to the American Cancer Society. I paid a small fortune to put all of this together the way I wanted it to be done. The point is to get the knowledge out there, and that's where you come in. It's to get it out there that there are tools, at least this tool, to help you when that overwhelming anxiety tells you it's over. It's all over. What is life about? What is spirituality about? That's one last thing I want to mention. Mm. I do also ask patients when we're in the room, mm-hmm. are you spiritual? Mm-hmm. And I stop and I pause and I say, now look at your reaction. For some, it's right away.
Yeah.
And for others, it's, oh no, here we go, a holy roller. And I said, no. I mean, sense of purpose, mm-hmm. sense of value, mm-hmm. sense of the whiness of you, the mm-hmm. whiness of the world, mm-hmm. ethics. Do you have a true north in terms of morality? Mm-hmm. Because if you are not spiritual now, I guarantee goddamn to you, you will be by the time we get into this.
Wow.
And they always are. They always are. It's a very, very, it's like the experience in a small sense of the parents in the beginning of neonatal medicine. This tiny little life trying to start. And now we have this not so tiny little life wondering, is it all over? Mm-hmm. Similar images are conjured up in both scenarios.
Yeah. Wow, this has been so fascinating and so informative. I know it's going to help so many of our listeners. I just want to thank you again, Dr. Ryan, for sharing your great wisdom today on Savvy Business Radio.
Oh, I had an absolute ball. You were very easy to talk to, and I felt extremely comfortable. And like I said, I hope we reach people out there. That's what it's about. I don't care if I sell one book. Yeah. Just get the message.
Yes, and I might be giving you a call, hopefully never soon in the future, but but thank you so much, Dr. Ryan.
It was an absolute pleasure, and say hi to your dog.
I will.
After 5 years of creating exciting business content with amazing businesses from around the world, Savvy is now creating a new video series entitled Heartbeat of the World. This series will feature experts from around the globe. We will highlight and discuss some of the greatest challenges facing the U.S. and the world. Co-create with us and find out more at bit.ly/savvypatron.